Well, shall we, let me just ask a couple of preliminary questions before we start. I'll lead in prayer in a moment, but there's still others that are coming in. Let me ask who you are a little bit, so I have a better idea of whom I'm speaking to. Are you... well, I'm glad to hear that. Is the new perspective something that most of you know a great deal about, or is it something that you're vaguely familiar with, or is it something that you really don't know much about at all? Could some of you volunteer to speak a bit so I know where you are? Yes. In Romania, yes.
Stephen Johnston, a doctoral student at Catholic University of Paris, Catholic Institute of Paris.
And have you been steeped in the new perspective?
I'm coming to become an evangelical again.
Well, that's a nice direction. Yes. Is this something that is on your agenda or vaguely on the horizon? It helps me to know where to pitch things, that's all. Because I have spent a fair bit of the last 3 or 4 years working on it, and I don't want to overload you with things, but I don't want to bore you either. So I just need to find out a bit more where you are.
I would be fairly vague on it, so... Uh-huh.
All right. I'm just trying to find out where people are in terms of their knowledge of the so-called new perspective. All right. Okay, that's very helpful to know. Are one or more of you here experts in the area, working a lot in Paul and maybe writing a dissertation or an habilitation schrift on Romans or something? No. You're writing on
religious and national identity. Uh huh.
Uh-huh. Where are you writing this?
In Rome. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. Point out as a from biblical theology,
yes.
Point of view, the definition of national, religious, and then Christian identity.
Yes.
How these terms overlap and how far we can historically actually overcome or abolish these categories, and how far Paul has been talking about historical and then,
Yes.
Existential levels.
Existential, yes. Yes, thank you.
Yeah. I teach Galatians in the Bible Institute for the teachers.
Yes. Yes. All right. That's just very helpful for me to get a better idea of where everyone is. All right, shall we begin with... Did you say that you need this shut off or down for the sake of... Or shut it down a bit. I mean, I'm happy with it on if you like. The colder, the better.
You know what? If it gets cold, just give me a warning and say, I'll turn it back on.
Okay. All right.
It's still on.
All right. It's called compromise. Let us bow in prayer. Lord God, as we begin to probe this difficult and complex subject, help us to have clarity of thought and good understanding both of various positions and of your most holy word. Forbid that we should be mere traditionalists. Forbid also that we should be immediately intoxicated by every new fad. But come back again and again to test things by your most holy word. In Jesus' name, amen. In one sense, the expression, the new perspective on Paul, is a bit of a misnomer, because it sounds as if it is one thing. In fact, the new perspective on Paul embraces something like 20 different positions. You may know that two or three of us are writing and editing a two-volume set, Justification and Variegated Gnomism. Volume 1 is out. Volume 2 on Paul is on the way. It should be out in another 8 or 9 months. And the first chapter in the second volume is by Stephen Westerholm, where he distinguishes, believe it or not, 39 separate positions on these matters. Now, those are fine points we don't need to worry about here. That's merely a way of saying, nevertheless, that I will sometimes resort to generalities that are true for some people who hold to the new perspective and not true for others. There are quite a lot of distinguishable positions in the so-called new perspective on Paul. But there are certain things that are common. Many of them go back to a couple of very important essays, not least Christoph Stendhal's essay on the introspective conscience of the West. That essay, written in the 60s, argued that we have come to read Paul in the light of Reformation notions of guilt, but that Paul himself shows no sign of guilt before he becomes a Christian. In other words, Paul does not show himself to be laboring under deep anxieties. He's going off, after all, to persecute Christians. And then suddenly he's converted, convinced that Jesus really is alive, and he's forced to reconsider a lot of things. But we have sometimes, Stendhal argues, misunderstood what Paul's theological arguments are about because, he says, we have been far too interested in Reformation categories that read the debates between Protestantism and Catholicism as if they were exact mirror images of the debates between Christians, Jews or otherwise, and Jews who were unconverted in the first century. Now, the crucial volume that set the agenda for the new perspective, however, was written by E.P. Sanders in 1977. Paul and Palestinian Judaism. The book is about 450 pages, and 300 pages of it are given to Second Temple Judaism, and then the last 150 pages to Paul. The argument of that book, in brief, is that a great deal of Protestant, and especially Lutheran, writing has handled texts very poorly. He argues that we have often appealed to 4th, 5th century AD Jewish writings in order to paint a picture of 1st century Jewish thought. In other words, you can find 4th and 5th century Talmudic sources which picture people coming to the judgment with long lists of both strong points and weak points of both good deeds and bad deeds, and how they all balance out in the balance of the scales of God's justice, works out according to God's perfect justice on the last day. Yes, you can find that sort of thing in 4th and 5th century Talmudic sources, but, he says, you cannot find such language or depictions in the first century. So, he says, a great deal of the picture of first century Judaism that we're familiar with from popularizing books like Alfred Edersheim, The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah, and so on, they are based on sources that are massively out of date. Would you want to create the Weltanschauung, the worldview of Shakespeare, by appealing to 20th century literature? That's the kind of time gap you're dealing with. So, he says, our creation of a certain kind of Judaism that is steeped with merit theology and that sort of thing is, in fact, massively out of date. After all, there were some huge changes that slowly developed in Judaism out of the destruction of the temple. But in the first century, before AD 70, the temple was the place where sins were atoned for. And by the time you get to the Tanaitic period, up to about 200 or so, then Jews, this side of the destruction of the temple, had to start developing notions about good deeds being the equivalent of sacrifices because they didn't have a sacrificial system that was left anymore. Yes, of course, but before AD 70, you don't find Jewish sources talking in exactly those lines. And so, he argues, If you come to understand first century Palestinian Judaism, he's not even talking so much about Philo and Alexandrian Judaism, first century Palestinian Judaism, then the entire construction of Jews steeped in merit theology and Christians preaching a doctrine of justification by grace, that is, in fact, merely a construction of the post-Reformation West, he argues. And in this connection, then, he invents a term which has become the standard bearer for what he understands first century Judaism to be, covenantal nomism. That is, nomism to do with nomos, the law, an approach to law that is essentially framed by the covenant. And in his view, what was typical of all forms of first century Jewish Judaism was an approach to covenantal nomism by which we are saved by grace and maintain ourselves by works. That is, we are saved by virtue of God's covenantal grace reaching out to the Jews. Deuteronomy 7, Deuteronomy 10, passages like that. And now the Jews have to maintain themselves by obedience to the covenant. Hence, there is a covenantal nomism, an approach to obeying the law as prescribed by a certain reading of Deuteronomy. And this, he says, you find in Josephus, you find in apocalyptic literature, you find in the earliest levels of the Targumim, you find them in rabbinic traditions that go back to the pre-70 period, pre-Tanaitic traditions and so forth. In every case, this is the pattern. And, he says, the same pattern you find in Paul. After all, he says, we're saved by grace in Paul, too, aren't we? But you still have to behave. If you don't behave in Paul, he starts putting a big question over whether you're truly saved. So he says that at that level, you analyze the text that way, and you've got covenantal nomism even in the early Christians. That's not the distinction. What then is the distinction between unconverted Jews and converted Jews converted Gentiles in the early church? He says that the fundamental distinction is, at the end of the day, Christology. Some people believe that Jesus is the Christ, and some people don't. Some people believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Christ, and others don't. Those who do are Christians, and those who don't aren't. Now, once you believe that Jesus is the Christ, then eventually other things have to be worked out. If you believe that Jesus is the Christ, and eventually come to believe that he died on the cross for your sins, then eventually that's going to reflect some judgments about what you think the temple does. So it begins to reconfigure Christian understandings of the sacrificial system and reconfigure Christian understandings of Judaism. But at the end of the day, Sanders goes so far as to say that Paul actually sometimes wrongly configures his opponent simply because he's trying to prove the correctness of his Christology. The dividing difference between Paul and his Jewish opponents is not grace versus works. It's Christology. And if you say, yes, but what about Paul's entire doctrine of sin? Well, he says, look at how Paul got to his position. He was heading off on the Damascus Road in order to persecute Christians when he suddenly becomes convinced by this revelatory appearance of the glorified and risen Christ that Jesus really is alive. That's a Christological conclusion. And then he's got to work things back. So he runs in his own development from solution to plight. Now in Romans, that's not the way it's presented. You have 2.5 chapters of plight. That is, you begin with 1:18, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all manner of unrighteousness, and so on, so on, so on, all the way up to 3:20 to prove that both Jew and Gentile are alike under sin, and then a great atonement passage. So you move from plight to solution. But in Paul's own psychology, in the account of Paul's own conversion, E.P. Sanders argues, you move from solution to plight. You begin with Christology, and then Paul's got to work out what difference that makes in order to support the Christology, and eventually, therefore, you get certain kinds of theological arguments, and after the fact, Paul makes the whole thing look like plight dissolution, but that's not the way it was in Paul's own experience. Now, that was the argument in E.P. Sanders' book in 1977. It is extraordinarily important. He can summarize his argument with the following 8 points. You can look them up yourself. Don't try to take them by mere dictation. But this is his own summary of what covenantal gnomism embraces. He refers to covenantal gnomism as a pattern of religion, not so much a series of theological propositions, but as a pattern of religion. Number one, God has chosen Israel. Number two, and given the law. God has chosen Israel and given the law. And the law implies both, number three, God's promise to maintain his election, and number four, the requirement to obey the covenantal stipulations embodied by the law. Number five, God rewards obedience and punishes transgression. Number six, and the law itself provides for a means of atonement, whether the morning and evening peace offerings or Yom Kippur or whatever, do you see? A means of atonement which results in, number seven, maintenance and reestablishment of the covenantal relationship. And number eight, all who are maintained in the covenant by obedience and by atonement and God's mercy belong to the group that will finally be saved. So that is his understanding of what the pattern of covenantal gnomism is, you see. And in large part, Christianity does exactly the same thing. It's simply that it replaces the law bits in there by Christ and his death. But the issue then becomes not law versus grace or merit versus unmerited favor. It becomes Christology. So far, E.P. Sanders. This was then developed by several influential people, not least James D.G. Dunn. I should say most emphatically that almost all the development in this area after E.P. Sanders was first and foremost by British writers, especially James D.G. Dunn and then by Tom Wright. And then since then, it has stretched out to people who were influenced by them, like Don Garlington and others. And now it is extended more broadly. There are relatively few defenders of this stance in the German world. The odd one, not many. And now even in the British world, it's now increasingly being attacked, actually. And there are more and more volumes that are actually calling this whole reconstruction itself into question. But we'll come to some of those works in due course. James D.G. Dunn. James D.G. Dunn is a professor at University of Durham. He was just ahead of me at Cambridge. We've known each other for a long time and have clashed in various interesting debates. A very personable chap, Methodist background, influenced by C.F. de Mol, and then eventually moved farther left than Mol on all kinds of things. Mol, for example, defends the deity of Christ in the strongest possible terms, whereas Jimmy Dunn developed a whole theory of Christology that pictured Christ as truly God only as the latest strand of Christian tradition, not before John's Gospel, and so forth. So he has moved in all kinds of interesting ways. He largely buys into E.P. Sanders' assessment of things, but the intriguing thing about Jimmy Dunn is that what his real interest is, it seems to me, is not so much theology per se, but reconstructing earliest Christian history. He sees himself in some ways as a von Harnack, except that von Harnack moved much more from the New Testament times into the second century, into the early patristic period, the sub-apostolic church. But Dunn is primarily interested in the reconstruction of early church history. And for years and years and years, he's focused on Paul and Acts and those matters. And now he's reflecting one stage further back, and all of his interests now are Gospels. and so forth. A very interesting man. The nature of his argumentation with respect to Christology, however, is itself very interesting. You see, he argues that Jewish monotheism, Jewish belief in one God, was so strong that the thing that you have to explain about Christianity is how Jesus could come to be worshipped as God. That he finds really difficult, which is one of the reasons why he has the highest affirmations of Jesus' deity in only the latest streams of first century theology. It's part of his reconstruction. So although he wants to say, with E.B. Sanders, that Christology lies at the heart of the distinction between Christianity and Judaism, nevertheless, in this parting of the ways, that's his expression, between Judaism and Christianity, the rise of Christology was not quick. It took many decades of careful, plodding development. And meanwhile, divisions were taking place between Judaism and Christianity that turned on what he called boundary markers. Now, if you talk to Tom Wright in private, Tom will tell you that Jimmy Dunn swiped the notion of boundary markers from him. I'm not going to pretend to adjudicate that one, who got it first. I don't know, and I really don't care. But the person who first promoted it extensively was certainly Jimmy Dunn. And he argues that Paul, precisely because of his more global vision, wants to break down those distinctive characteristics of Judaism which, in fact, keep Gentiles out. So that although the Jews under the Old Covenant are the locus of the people of God, nevertheless, with Christ and the New Covenant, although the same covenantal structures apply, nevertheless, they're bringing in all kinds of other people. And the question is how to bring down those barriers so that they don't get in the way. And the kinds of things that are most telling to Jews to preserve the social identity of Jews, then, are circumcision, the food laws, Sabbath, and such other public observances. So, he says, when you come to a book like Galatians, just think how important a place circumcision plays, do you see? And thus, Jimmy Dunn writes a commentary on Galatians, which is an extension of the trajectory from E.P. Sanders. Do you see? It's a reconfiguration of the Galatians book that is a long way removed from, let's say, Luther's reading or Calvin's reading of it, and much more in terms of social identity, of the marks of social self-identity by Jews and by Christians during the Pauline period. These boundary markers, then, are bound up with the law, but in fact, in all of his earlier writings, James Dunn eventually changed this a bit, he argues that the expression, the works of the law, itself is an expression that refers to these boundary markers, not to legalism, not to merit theology, not to keeping the whole law, but that the expression, the works of the law, refers in particular to those works which are, in fact, boundary markers. Now, Jimmy Dunn himself has backed off that one just a wee bit now. He thinks now that most of them run along those lines, but challenged as he has been by Douglas J. Moo in his commentary in an important article in NTS and elsewhere, and by Joe Fitzmyer and a lot of other people, the result is that he now acknowledges in a few crucial passages, not least in Romans 4 and some other passages, he acknowledges that works of the law can take on a more comprehensive notion of obedience to the law, not merely in the domain of boundary markers, but comprehensively. So, in some sense, Jimmy Dunn is now self-correcting a wee bit in his more recent writings in this regard. He has written, of course, a major commentary on Romans as well. That brings us to Tom Wright, N.T. Wright. He and I were exact contemporaries. He was at Oxford and I was at Cambridge, and we used to get together in the summer and talk about all kinds of things. he did not always hold this position. In fact, he started off with what might be called a traditionally reformed position in all kinds of areas. In fact, a traditionally reformed Calvinistic position as opposed to a Lutheran position on all kinds of issues. He is a very capable speaker and writer. He couldn't be boring if he tried. He is engaging and extremely effective in debate, and very quick, and on many, many fronts, he has done the church an enormous amount of good. He has taken on some of the strongest voices in the Jesus Seminar, which is deeply, deeply committed to philosophical naturalism, and his little book, Who is Jesus, for example, which takes on such extreme people as Barbara Thiering and people like that, is one that I've given away to students myself. It's a very helpful book and is quite stinging in its creative dismantling of Jesus Seminar skepticism. So Tom Wright, you must understand, has done a great deal of good in many, many domains. And then when in Britain, a certain writer who created an unbelievable pall, got a lot of publicity, he promptly came out with a book, What St. Paul Really Said. Was Paul of Tarsus the real founder of Christianity, which is what had been argued in this other book. That's a 1997 publication, and in many ways it's a very good book, although there are some points of it where I would disagree. If you want to see a really clever, outrageously funny essay taking on John Dominic Crossan and the Jesus Seminar folk, I refer you to an essay that is titled Taking the Text with Her Pleasure, A Post-Postmodernist Response to John Dominic Crossan, the Historical Jesus. Now, that's only a brief essay. It first appeared in the magazine, the journal, Theology, in 1993. It was outrageously funny. It pictures the text talking to John Dominic Crossan. It is the best kind of satire I've seen in theological circles for a long time. He wrote it. He was supposed to give a critical review at SBL, the Society of Biblical Literature, at a plenary session in the United States. And he hadn't done it when he arrived the night before, and he stayed up all night to write it. I mean, he wrote it on a manuscript overnight and then read it the next day and eventually polished it and published it. It is outrageously funny. People were rolling in the aisle. I mean, even if you disagreed with a man, it was so cleverly put. It's not often in Society of Biblical Literature that you get people laughing. But he is an extremely capable man. And if you want to see really good satire on some of these debates, then I do strongly recommend that you get to a good library and look up Theology. It's published at Cambridge, 1993, Taking the Text with Her Pleasure. So Tom is a very interesting man. On the other hand, in more recent years, he has adopted a nexus of positions that are all tied together. He would argue that Jesus had no consciousness that he was God. Now, he doesn't want to deny that Jesus was God, but he does deny that Jesus had any consciousness that he was God. He's working on a 5-volume set at the moment. Volume 3 has just appeared. He's also written an important book, The Climax of the Covenant, which is his thought in brief form. Much of what he does, especially on the Gospels, is really very helpful indeed. For example, with respect to the historical Jesus, he asks these questions and comes out with solid responses in every case. Did Jesus' aims remain consistent throughout his life? Did he go to Jerusalem to die? Did he intend to found the church? Why did he die? How and why did the early church begin? Why are the Gospels what they are? And in every case, he's got solid, responsible, constructive, thoughtful, engaging answers that take on the most extreme forms of the new perspective. Now, the heart of Wright's programmatic agenda, I think, can be put like this. The exile is not over. or at some superficial level, you've come to the end of the 70 years, but you take a look at the pre-exilic promises of what God would do at the end of the exile, and they seem far too extravagant for what actually took place. I mean, when the people actually returned, 43,000 of them, there was no restoration of the monarchy, there was no land flowing with milk and honey. They went back and built a two-bit temple, and even that took a long time. And then on top of that, they were variously under the Persians and then under the Greeks and then squeezed between the Seleucids in the north and the Ptolemaics in the south. And then the guerrillas took over. And I mean, where is the sense of fulfillment from the pre-exilic prophecies, do you see? So he cites the Jewish texts which point out that in some ways there are pre-exilic promises of restoration that have not been fulfilled. So that all the way down to Jesus' day, there is, he argues, a large consciousness that the exile has not ended. Jesus then comes along to end the exile and bring in Yahweh's promises of restoration. In so doing, he directs attention away from Torah and temple to himself, and claims, in effect, to constitute the true Israel. And that claim brings in Jews and Gentiles alike. Now, you see, much of this, historic Christians would agree with. That is to say, Jesus is the locus of the true Israel and constitutes the true continuity of the people of God, and Jew and Gentile are alike one in him. That is common ground. But now it is all primarily cast in terms of bringing in the end of the exile, the restoration of all things, except that it is now ratcheted up, as it were, into a larger framework in which Gentiles are also included, and the locus of Israel is, in fact, Jesus himself. This thematic of the end of the exile, he sees everywhere. A lot of people have seen that there is some level of Judaism which does talk about the end of the exile. People have seen that for a long time. In my 1981 commentary on Matthew, for example, I appeal to those Jewish traditions as part of the background behind Matthew 2's Rachel weeping for her children passage. People have acknowledged that that's part of the background. But he makes it so important, hermeneutical key for understanding what is going on in the Gospels, that even the parable of the prodigal son, Luke 15, 11 to 32, is to be read this way. It is not about wayward individuals, sinful individuals rebelling against God, who are now coming back in repentance and who are being received by the Heavenly Father. Rather, it is about Israel's homecoming. So everything now becomes a function of end of exile. One of the effects then is that all of God's victory, after all, the title of the book in which this is most clearly laid out is Jesus and the Victory of God, is that all of God's victory is bound up in Jesus. And thus he reads the Gospels as not having any reference at all to the parousia or to the end of the age or all the like. It is all tied to Jesus' victory, whether in the cross at AD 70 or to the victory as tied to the fall of the temple in AD 30, or to the victory of Jesus as exemplified by the fall of the temple in AD 70. Thus Jesus does not ask for repentance as customarily understood, that is, sorrow and rejection of and turning away from sin. That's not what Jesus is on about. But rather in the sense of turning away from revolutionary zeal and turning to Jesus. Turning away from self-identity as the people of God and turning to Jesus as the locus of the true people of God. Faith, then, becomes loyalty to or trust in the leader, Jesus himself. And the sinners are the notoriously wicked. And even these can, of course, be admitted. How, then, is this tied to Paul? This is still being worked out in his work, but eventually it comes to this. Because of these structures and this vision of of Jesus as the true locus of Israel and so forth, justification is, in Tom Wright, redefined. Now, this is not so for all of the New Perspective people, but Tom's influence here is very significant. Tom understands justification to be God's declaration that you are in the covenant community. Not God's declaration that you are just entering the covenant community. It is an ongoing status thing. In other words, you are ongoingly justified as God ongoingly declares you to be in the covenant community. So it is not bound up with the beginning of your Christian experience as it is in traditional Protestantism. In Tom, it still is declarative. It's not quite that way in other New Perspective people. But with Tom, it's declarative. But it's not declarative that you are just. It's declarative, rather, that you are in the community, that you are in the covenant bond. And in a certain sense, therefore, ecclesiology is now being raised above soteriology. Now, there are further developments that we could take with Don Garlington and Scott Hafeman and others, but I think I'm going to stop there for a few moments and ask if there are questions that you would like to raise merely about what the New Perspective is before we press on to start thinking about how to understand it, how to respond to various parts of it, and so forth. Questions, comments? This is merely by way of information. At this point, I'm not trying to either judge it or condemn it or justify it. I'm merely trying to describe it as neutrally and as carefully as I can. And you will see in due course that I do not think that all of it is wrong, although I think that substantial parts are. Yeah.
In terms of the placing of ecclesiology above soteriology, what would you see as the long-term implications of evangelization? And in a sense, is evangelization, as the Catholics would use it,
yes,
a more appropriate word than evangelism as?
Yes. Yes, the question is, what are the long-term implications of placing ecclesiology above soteriology? Now, in all fairness to Tom, he does not like me to say... I mean, we still talk about these things, you know, occasionally have a breakfast together or something at SBL. So I'm not saying anything behind his back. But he does not like me to say that he's placing ecclesiology above soteriology. But on the other hand, he is. a friend of mine, who shall remain nameless, an Australian... with all of the Australian propensities for getting to the heart of an issue. He once tackled Tom in a question and answer session at Tyndale House, Cambridge, 7 or 8 years ago, after Tom was expounding some of these matters at considerable length. And after the session, this brother went up to Tom and said, "Tom, the phone rings in the middle of the night, and a woman in your parish... an aged woman says, 'I've just found out I've only got a short while to live. Please come and see me.' So you get dressed and rush off, and you get to her bedside and discover she has about 10 minutes to live. And she takes your hand and she says, 'Tom, what must I do to be saved?' What are you going to tell her?" And Tom said, and I quote, "Well, that's a good question. I'll have to think about that." Now, that already indicates a certain problem, wouldn't you say? I mean, if your reconstructions have not added clarity to something of that sort, there's a problem there somewhere. Now, in all fairness, Tom would be able to answer that one today precisely because somebody caught him out on it, and Tom is a very good debater. But my friend, not willing to let it go, said, "Well, let me give you some options. Would you say you must believe in Jesus in order to belong to the covenant?" And Tom is too shrewd merely to say yes. because he could see the nasty implications of that. And meanwhile, Tom himself has written some fine little devotional materials on the cross and so on. But at the end of the day, those materials all have to do with sort of the antecedent preparation that deal with sin so that God will declare you perpetually to be in the covenant. So part of it is not denying the importance of the cross, but then no Christian of any persuasion, no one in broad-stream confessional Christendom of any sort, whether you're Catholic or Orthodox or Protestant of various shapes and sizes and dimensions, would want to deny the significance of the cross. The question really is how the cross is related to such fundamental matters as justification, coming to faith, and so on, so on, so on, how it is related to law. It's how the thing is configured, how it's put together, do you see? And where is the self-identity of the people of God in that frame of reference? And this is not quite the same thing as historic Catholicism and historic Protestantism. It is not, where at the end of the day, you have a kind of primal importance of belonging to the right group, the church, in order to be saved, versus a traditional Protestant understanding, which raises soteriology above ecclesiology. Thus, even an apostle Paul can say, though we or an angel from heaven preach some other gospel, let him be anathema. In other words, the gospel takes a certain kind of priority status, even above apostolic authority, if I may put it that way. And then within that kind of framework, then, that defines who is in or who is out. And your church takes on definition from the gospel rather than the other way around. Now, it's a bit different here, in all fairness. But nevertheless, there are some relations. And one of the things I did not go into, is that there is one whole strand of the new perspective. You find it in Garlington, and you find it in some others, but it's pretty strong in Garlington. And you find it likewise in Wright, where the issue then is not that God demands that you be sinlessly perfect. God simply demands that you belong to the covenant. And thus sin tends to be downplayed just a wee bit. It's not that sin doesn't exist, or that it's not important. But God is not demanding perfection, just as he didn't demand perfection of the Old Testament. Rather, he demanded broad covenantal faithfulness, which meant that when you did sin, well, you had Yom Kippur, the blood of bull and goats to look after things, you see. And now God does not really demand perfection either in terms of covenantal faithfulness. You have the blood of Jesus to look after things, you see. So there is a different way of configuring all of these things, and the issue of sin gets jiggered a bit. It gets reconfigured in that kind of framework as well. So that inevitably, how you preach the gospel, how you approach these things, how you appeal to people, it does all get shifted a wee bit. Yes, it does. On the other hand, I could introduce you to some people who have bought into some parts of the new perspective who are pretty virulent evangelists just the same. I mean, there are many different shades. It has to be acknowledged. Life is complex.
I've seen that myself.
Yes. Yes. Yes, yes. But you might confuse me first.
Yeah. Maybe I'm confused. So
yeah.
Maybe.
Well, we'll share our confusion.
Yeah. The question is going to be a little bit confusing, so I'm just looking for the solution together in this discussion. When we talk about ecclesiology, soteriology, Christology, and everything, those different levels, so we have different disciplines.
Yes,
now
yes, yes.
But I don't think that these issues are the issues of the first Christian community. They base and they define themselves on the recognition of Jesus, not as a Christ, but as a Messiah. And Messiah was that vocation, that function, mission of Jesus. And that very question of his identity was the question why Jews had to eliminate also this group of the people who recognized in Jesus the Messiah and the Son of God. I would ask nowadays, our theological discussion happens to be discussion, academical discussion, under the roof of civic society, where our theological questions are not, I would say, they don't influence directly our practical life, because theology does not form the world order, and so we can discuss quite quietly these issues, and there are no heretics nowadays, because you can find a place and a platform for a discussion. But those institutional forms of Judaic Christianity, there are still issues, and you know, Lutherans and Catholics, they signed a document about justification and about theologically actually reconcilable positions. I would ask how far we can discuss these issues without coming to the reality and to the institutional reconciliation, and how far this matter of that question I met in Rome, Tom Wright, and discussing with him. I am a Catholic, and I discussed with him certain issues. You are not Catholic, you are Protestant. And I asked him, what does it mean for our dialogue now? Mm-hmm. I'm not dying, I'm not that old lady. What I am supposed to do?
I think you have three or four questions in your question, and one or two of them I want to deal with a little later.
All right.
But let me mention one or two things just the same. You are right that there are different domains of discussion, and the categories of systematic theology are not always the categories of the first century. However, as I use Christ and Messiah, I will use them equivalently. So I'm not trying to import something surreptitiously. By Christology, I mean messianism. Now, it can be pre-Christian or post-Christian messianism, but it's the same thing. I acknowledge, in fact, I will later insist, that some of our discussions on these matters of justification and sanctification and so on have been influenced by reformational and counter-reformational systematic categories that we have sometimes read back into the New Testament, and that some of the questions that E.P. Sanders and others have raised are helpful historical questions that must be addressed. I will agree with that. On the other hand, that does not mean that I think that they've got all the right answers, even if they've asked some of the right questions, and that there are ways of demonstrating ties between some of the things that Paul talks about and some of the things that Calvin or Luther talk about, rather than all the disjunctions that the contemporaries want to put in. But I will come to that in due course. In the larger issue of whether or not we can usefully speak of these things in our culture where they don't matter very much, then I would want to argue that the issue can be put this way. Until fairly recently, some form of Christendom or another controlled many of the thought structures of the Western world, so that when you talked about these things, you were engaging with broad-scale intellectual history of the West. Even when I was doing university missions 20 or 30 years ago, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, if I dealt with an atheist, the atheist was a Christian atheist. That is, the God that he or she was denying was the Christian God, which meant that the categories were still on my turf. But today, if I'm dealing with an atheist, I have a mission, for example, at Yale this fall, and now if I deal with a mission there, they are completely and utterly and totally biblically illiterate. So now if you're dealing with an atheist, you're dealing with an atheist who does not have Christian categories. We've so far moved away from the heritage of Judeo-Christian givens that there is a sense in which our disputes and discussions and so on in these matters do seem to be increasingly abstracted from the world around us. Now, I'm going to be dealing partly with that issue in tomorrow's seminar on postmodernism. But I would want to argue that in every culture, whether Christianity is going into Thailand and is wrestling with Buddhism, or it's going into Japan and it's wrestling with Shintoism, or it's going into a pre-1989 communist materialist structure. In every case, there are some points where Christianity will overlap with a culture and some points where it will contradict the culture. And if the culture at certain points wants to argue that Christianity is irrelevant here, or it doesn't apply here, or it has to be understood differently here, or anything like that, then my response would be, got to change the culture. In other words, part of mission is precisely to change the expectations and structures as to what's going on, what's important, how to look at things. Otherwise, it seems to me, Christianity is always domesticated. So at that level, you see, I would want to say that if the broader culture today does not understand these categories, that simply means we have to spend more time doing our job better. And I'll come to some of that tomorrow. Now, on larger issues of Catholic Protestant, we'll come to some of that when we get into these. Is that scratching where you're itching? Yes? Good. Now, I've been told that every once in a while I have to stop and leave time for the tape to be changed. Are we there yet, or do I need to... Okay? 1 minute time out. While they're changing the videotape back there. And now we'll run now till 11:30, and then we'll stop for coffee, and then we'll come back and continue. Is that fair?
Yes.
It only takes about 30 seconds or so, but yeah.
Okay.
All right. Now, I want to suggest then that it's useful to think about these matters in these eight different categories that I've listed on the outline in front of you. All of these eight categories could easily take up 2 or 3 hours of lecture time without even beginning to scratch the surface. But I will spend more time on some of them and less time on others, but it's important to begin to understand these matters. First, it's very important to see that we are inevitably deeply embroiled, whether we like it or not, in disputes about historical theology. Most of those who subscribe to one form or another of the new perspective have fairly slighting and dismissive approaches to the Reformation or to medieval theology, to both, as being fundamentally dealing with categories that do not interest the Apostle Paul in particular. But what I would want to argue in the first instance is that sometimes the domains of discourse, though they are different, if you pay attention, you can nevertheless translate. Let me give you a couple of examples. In standard Reformation thought, this is both in Lutheranism and in Calvinism, men and women are justified by grace alone through faith alone, and then subsequently are sanctified. So the justification, then, in this heritage, refers to God's once-for-all declarative act by which we are declared just before Him by virtue of Christ's crosswork. And certainly in Calvin, and already in principle in Luther, although Luther tweaks things slightly differently, not only are our sins imputed to Christ, but Christ's righteousness is ours and is usually thought to be imputed to us as well within justification. And in the broader stream of things, usually this is understood to be underlaid by union with Christ, because we are united with Christ, and Christ died, but we were crucified with Him, and Christ rises, but we rise with Him. This is the underlay for our justification. And then, having been justified, we are then sanctified progressively by the transforming work of the Spirit all the rest of our lives. That's sort of standard a Protestant soteriology, is it not? And then we look ultimately for glorification and the transformation of the body on the last day. Now, John Calvin was not a stupid man, and precisely because he was both a systematician writing the Institutes and a commentator writing endless commentaries on every book of the New Testament except the Apocalypse, and on many books of the Old Testament. Therefore, he tended to have his finger on the text and noticed all kinds of things that systematicians themselves don't always notice. And he noticed, for example, that there were not a few passages in Paul in which the hagios word group, from which we get our word sanctification, does not deal with the progress of redemption or the progress of transformation. And so Reformed people could speak of positional sanctification or definitional sanctification. That is to say, of sanctification that is as instantaneous and is as initiatory as justification, but in a different realm. Justification, on this view, has to deal with matters of justice before God. Sanctification has to deal with matters of cult, of ritual, of possession, of ownership, of ritual, of cult before God. Thus, for example, in the Old Testament, the shovel that takes out the ash from the high altar is called holy. Not because it's moral, not because it's divine, not because it is growing in sanctification, but precisely because it is set aside for God. It is peculiarly God's. And likewise, for example, the unconverted husband or the unconverted wife in 1 Corinthians 7 is called holy, sanctified, not because he or she is even a Christian. Certainly not because they're growing in holiness, but because in certain ways, by being in a home in which one of the adults is in fact a Christian, that person has been set aside for God in some way, thus owned by God in some special way. Do you see? Likewise, when Paul writes to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 3, he addresses them as all who are sanctified in Christ Jesus. Well, transparently, this is a singularly unsanctified church in a Reformed sense. And then he calls them sanctified in Christ Jesus, and then he says, called to be holy. And thus there is a sense, you see, in which he is saying that they are sanctified. Now they jolly well better start acting like it. It's part of a fairly common New Testament ethical appeal, be what you are. And thus they are already possessed by God, just as they are already justified. They are already sanctified. They are already justified. And now they are to work out this relationship with God, both in the realm of justice and in the realm of holiness, in terms of growth in conformity to Christ. Now, some have argued, such as David Peterson, for example, an Australian who is the principal of Oak Hill College, in his book Possessed by God, he goes so far as to argue that either all or most of the Pauline passages on sanctification, on the Hagios word group, in fact, have to do with positional or definitional sanctification. That is, he's not convinced that any of them have to do with growth in grace. Now, suppose, for argument's sake, that he's right. And even if he's not right about all of them, he's certainly right about most of them. But even if you argue that he's only right about most of them, does this mean that the traditional understanding of sanctification is overthrown? No, it does not. Because, you see, Paul certainly speaks of growth in grace in many passages, even when he does not use the term sanctification. Thus, for example, in Philippians 3, we find the apostle speaking about forgetting those things which are behind and pressing on toward those things which are ahead. And I do not count myself already to have attained, but leaving these things behind, and so on, so on, so on. Likewise, Hebrews speaks of laying aside the weight of things that so easily ensnare us, and so on, so on, so on. There are lots of passages in the New Testament that speak in terms of growth in grace and increasing conformity to Jesus Christ, even when the Hagios word group is not used. In other words, the Reformation doctrine of sanctification is certainly taught again and again and again in Scripture, even when the word group isn't there to support it. So when you start recognizing that you are in a different domain of discourse, you see, you realize that sometimes the domain of discourse of systematic theology, influenced as it is by certain forms of historical theology, may in fact not be entirely aligned with the exegetical conclusions of those who are keeping their fingers on the text. But it does not always mean that the doctrine itself is wrong. It means that it's attached at the wrong place. Or it has to be grounded somewhat differently. It can't merely be tied to a certain set of word groups, do you see? And that has to be borne in mind in these sorts of discussions, it seems to me. And sometimes, even after you have overturned a particular word use, it does not mean an entire doctrine is overturned. It merely means that you're in a different domain of discourse and you've got to watch what you're attaching to what. So, there are a lot more things to talk about in that domain, but I would be prepared to argue at some length that Jimmy Dunn's understanding of Luther himself is notoriously misguided. I don't think he understands Luther. I think he's got a caricature of Luther. I think he is caricaturizing Luther at least as badly as he thinks Protestants have caricaturized Paul. And so there are different layers of possible misunderstandings as we start rejecting this group or that group. You see, now, that's not something that I can spend more time on now. Second, to get back to foundations, we need to come back to E.P. Sanders' seminal work. For although there were, in fact, preliminary works by Kaseman and Stendhal and others before E.P. Sanders, the seminal study that kicked off the new perspective was doubtless Paul and Palestinian Judaism, 1977, which I took some time to describe to you. How right was that book? That is a question that has to be asked. And it has to be said that until fairly recently, an awful lot of Pauline and other studies have simply argued that E.P. Sanders was right. And E.P. Sanders is a bit like Tom Wright in this regard. He's a very gifted debater, very quick on his feet. I've seen him at SBL meetings, for example, where when somebody asks him a really difficult question about some first century Jewish text that doesn't quite fit in his paradigm. Ed Sanders, his name is. Ed will snap back, "Have you read that entire corpus in the original? Because if you haven't, you don't have the right to ask the question." I mean, he is a very aggressive debater. And so it takes somebody equally aggressive to answer back, "Stop bluffing and answer the question." I mean, you don't get anywhere with Ed unless you... unless you confront him on his own on his own turf. And the most you can get him to say in public debate is not, "Oops, I got that one wrong." It's, "I'll have to think about that." I mean, he is a very tough-minded debater and a very gifted man. Nevertheless, increasingly, although people began to buy into his construction of covenantal gnomism, and it affected a lot of the writings of John Barclay, and it affected to some extent Scott Hafeman, certainly Jimmy Dunn and all of his protégés and so on. Although the influence has been vast and is increasingly found in evangelical confessional circles as well. Yet, in all fairness, I want to say that although Ed Sanders gets some of this material right, there is some of it, in my view, that is profoundly mistaken. And there is a rising recognition that is the case. This is not Don Carson speaking out of turn, or I'm certainly not saying that I get it all right. The literature is vast and complex. But let me start raising some issues. Now, if you want to look at the literature on it, I think now that probably the best refutation is Volume 1 of Justification and Variegated Gnomism. Certainly not because I'm one of the editors, but precisely because the people we got were all experts in the area. 600 pages of technical discussion where we tried to find the best experts we could find in the area of apocalyptic and the best area of people we could find on Josephus and so on, to do fresh studies of all of these areas. And the consensus of the entire argument is that although covenantal gnomism might be a useful category for some of the literature, it really is very distorted for other parts of the literature, and there are other things that are really quite wrong. So let me try to explain where Ed is right and where he's wrong. He is right. He is admirably right to keep insisting that we do not have the right to read 4th, 5th, and subsequent century Jewish sources back into the 1st century. And there is no doubt that a fair bit of Protestantism did make that sort of mistake. Especially German Lutheranism. It is not a universal mistake, but it was more commonly a mistake in German Lutheranism than elsewhere. In the English-speaking world, it tended to be found especially amongst those who still refer to Edesheim repeatedly. Edesheim was himself a godly man. He didn't know how to use his own Jewish sources very well at an historical level. As soon as those questions have been asked, then all you have to do is spend 15 minutes with Eddersheim and see what his sources are, because he quotes them all. And if you have any sense of when the Tanaitic period runs and when the Amoraic period runs and when the Talmudim start and so on, first the Jerusalem Talmud and then the Babylonian Talmud and so on, you quickly discover that the charge is amply justified again and again and again and again. On the other hand, the whole notion of covenantal gnomism and entering by grace and maintaining yourself by works is astonishingly slippery. For, you see, the notion of entering by grace is, for Jews, an historic notion that goes back to the very foundation of Israel. It's not that any particular Jew in the first century enters by grace. He or she is simply born into the covenant. Whereas when you're talking about Christians entering by grace, it's entering by grace into something in which they were not born. When you're talking about Gentiles entering, do you see? And thus the parallel between whatever it means to belong to Judaism under the rubric of covenantal gnomism, and whatever it means for a Gentile to become a Christian under the same rubric. In fact, you're talking about very different things. In the one case, you're talking about conversion. In the other case, you're talking about an entire displacement of a people by God a millennium and a half earlier, do you see? Or if you want to go back to Abraham, 2 millennia earlier. Thus, the comparisons are not all that apt. But it's more than that. You quickly discover that even when some of the sources seem at a certain superficial level to be saying the same thing as Paul, closer study shows that they're not. For whatever reason, in his 1977 book, E.P. Sanders did not study Josephus. If I recall, he mentions Josephus only 3 times. Now, that's astonishing for a start, because whatever else Josephus was, he was a first century Palestinian Jew. Now, in later writings, then he discusses Josephus at some length, so we'll pull in those other works as well. And he points out that Josephus himself speaks of grace not infrequently. Take a look at the Hengstorf Concordance of Josephus, for example, and discover how often Josephus uses grace. But I've looked up every single passage where charis is used in Josephus. And what you discover is something very interesting. Again and again and again, when Josephus actually appeals to charis and says that so-and-so received some benefit from God by God's charis or the like, then Josephus repeatedly asks the question, and was this charis given to the man because he deserved it, or because he did not deserve it? And Josephus replies, well, of course, because he deserved it, otherwise God would not be fair. So you see, although Josephus is speaking of charis, that is not exactly Paul's notion of charis, you see. If you have any doubt on the matter, read Romans 4 and his distinction between what is given by merit, as in work, you work for it, or it's given simply as a gift, you see? When Paul raises, in other words, the similar question, he answers precisely 180 degrees opposite to what Josephus does. And then there are other books. The precise dating of 4th Ezra to Esdras is disputed, but probably it goes back to the first century Palestinian world all right. And it is very difficult to deny pretty strong merit theology within that frame of reference. And so on. The sources go on and on and on. And at this point, one wants to start arguing that the treatment of the sources is too uniform. They are all made to fit in this category of covenantal gnomism without recognizing the enormous distinctions that you get within Judaism itself. Now, It has to be said, too, that this one is a much harder argument to quantify in the very nature of the case, but it needs to be raised. It has to be said that our access to ancient religions are often through the literature, but we often don't know what people on the street thought quite. This, you may have heard of the Annal school of historiography. The Annal school of historiography in France is very interesting. It stands over against the sort of great thinker school of approach, where you study a great scholar and then another great scholar and then another writer and then a dramatist and then an artist and then a great politician and a great general, and this is how you study history. But the Annal school of historiography is really much more interested in what happens amongst locals on one particular day in 1314 somewhere, you see? So did you get the wonderful book by Le Roi Ladurie, Maredsous? It's been translated into English. I don't know if it's been translated into German, but it's you can read it in French or English in any case. Maredsous, M-A-R-E-D-S-O-U-S. Well worth your while reading. It's really one day in the life of the village, Maredsous, in the High Middle Ages. That's all it is. And he's used all kinds of records and archives and ancient descriptions to find out what an ordinary housewife is going through and what an ordinary child is going through and what they're doing on the farm and what the local priest is doing. And so instead of thinking about the great religious leaders and movements, there's an attempt to try to find out what's going on in one little village. Did you see in the Pyrenees? Now, let me put it this way. If you're an Anglican, for example, and you read the 39 articles, you will have a certain view of Anglican theology. If you're a Lutheran, and you read the Lutheran confessions, begin with Augsburg perhaps, or whatever, then you will have a certain view of Lutheran theology. Does that mean that all Lutherans really understand, believe, toe the line, agree to Augsburg? Or that all Anglicans act in line, believe in line, confess in line with the 39 articles? I don't think so. At the street level, there is a constant move. I don't care whether you're a Catholic or an evangelical or whatever you are. There's a constant drift in one fashion or another to some form of merit theology, isn't there? You know, you watch evangelicals, you know, will God zap me today because I haven't had my devotions properly? Now, of course, nobody actually goes so far as to put it that bluntly, but nevertheless, some of that's there, isn't there? So one wants to ask, what is going on in first century Judaism? Do you find out what is going on in first century Judaism just by reading 4QMMT at Qumran? Did you see? And in that sense, you see, the Gospels themselves become primary sources of debates about what's going on in Judaism. They are not sources to be disallowed as part of the understanding, so that when Jesus describes what's going on in Pharisees' life, on the one hand, yes, the Hasidim were amongst the noblest and the finest and the most religious and the most respected and all the rest. That's precisely the group in which you start getting a great deal of self-justification and pride and arrogance. It's an entirely a world in which you can imagine a publican and a Pharisee going to the temple and one saying, "I thank God that I'm not as other men are." Can't you find bona fide evangelicals going to church and saying, in effect, "I thank God that I'm not as other men are," in slums and poverty and degradation and with AIDS and so on. I do thank you that I'm... Well, isn't that the part of the same thing? Do you see? So suddenly the Gospels themselves become powerful witnesses to the dynamic of what takes place at the local level, at the street level, at the lay level, at the common people level. And that must not be overlooked when you start talking about what Jesus was arguing with, because Jesus was not arguing simply with academicians. He was interested in ordinary folk. Now, we'll come to more of these questions, but now it's time for coffee. You might want to tell the gentleman to shut off the camera. All right, let's recommence, shall we? And what I propose to do now in We go to 115, is that right? I think we go to 115 now.
Yes?
I will stop every once in a while for questions and answers so that if I say something too obscure, you will have a chance to get back to me. Now, the third and fourth points on the list, the third I will deal with very quickly, the fourth I will say a little more about. Part of the problem in these discussions, it seems to me, is the danger of what Samuel Sandmel, a Jewish scholar who died a few years ago, used to call parallelomania. It's a wonderful expression. He wrote an article in Journal of Biblical Literature about 30 years ago called Parallelomania. What he means by parallelomania is there is a form of exegesis which looks at all the parallels in either the Greco-Roman world or in Judaism, and when you find the parallels, you read those parallels into the text that you're studying. Now, if you want some examples of this, if you read, for example, Hans Dieter Betz, his commentary on Galatians in the Hermeneia series and the EKK, then you discover that Betz, bless his heart, who's interested only in the Hellenistic background, he reads Hellenistic parallels into passage after passage after passage after passage in Galatians and domesticates the text of Galatians by the parallels. In fact, Betz is not even sure that Paul actually knew any Hebrew. On the other hand, you find a scholar who is steeped in Jewish background and doesn't know much about Hellenistic backgrounds, you know, it's sort of a superficial knowledge, but really knows apocalyptic material well and Jewish stuff and Judaism and so on, then all of the parallels that you find start justifying another reading of Paul. And at some point you have to ask, at what point are you actually reading Paul in the light of your selected background and end up domesticating Paul? Will you allow Paul to speak for yourself? I would be prepared to argue that there are quite a few writers who are quite good at dealing with backgrounds and less able at the level of just straight exegesis. Now, the backgrounds are important, don't misunderstand me, because these texts are not abstracted from the world in which they were given. That's correct. And not every background is as important as every other background. But when I was doing a whole lot of work on John's Gospel a number of years ago, I read a very interesting article by Robert Kaiser, written in the Canadian Journal of Theology, now defunct, about 35 years ago. And what he did was examine all of the writings of Rudolf Bultmann and all of the writings of C.H. Dodd on the Johannine Prologue and categorized every single extra-biblical reference. In other words, they had both written extensively on John 1, 1-18, the Johannine Prologue, and they had both done a lot of work on background studies in the Hermetica and Philo and the Jewish literature and Gnostic sources and so on. And he categorized then all of their appeals of evaluation to antecedent literature. Now, in some cases, they raised possible sources only to dismiss them, and others they raised the sources in order to justify them. But they evaluated a lot of different sources. One, interestingly enough, had appealed to 306 different extra-biblical texts. The other had appealed to 308 extra-biblical texts. Guess what the percentage of overlap was? 7%. Does that tell you something? You see, the antecedent literature is vast. And you can come out with vastly different readings of the text itself by appeal to a certain kind of parallel. This is what Samuel Sandmel called parallelomania. You see, you can domesticate texts by appealing to parallels. Now, there is a certain kind of parallelophobia as well. In parallelophobia, you refuse to anchor texts in their historical context. You refuse to learn anything from the surrounding text. That's clearly also a mistake, because God disclosed himself in real space-time history. But nevertheless, one does worry endlessly about the danger of domesticating New Testament texts by constant appeal, let us say, to exile, or constant appeal to a certain kind of Jewish background, or a certain Hellenistic background, or in the case of E.P. Sanders, to a certain kind of covenantal gnomism, which is, in fact, itself a construct. And then once the construct is in place, Paul has to be fit within that construct. But the question has to be raised is this: is it possible that even if the construct is in part right, Paul, in fact, himself, is doing something else? So that even if you have discovered that there is an important set of questions regarding the so-called boundary markers of Judaism, you have to ask if Paul is treating those same boundary markers as boundary markers or as something else. Or else you will end up, inevitably, domesticating Paul. Now, those are questions I merely raise here. I don't have time to pursue them more now. Now we'll come to some word study issues. Let me suggest to you some sources in this area. The first volume of Justification and Variegated Gnomism, the essay by Mark Seifried on the Tzavak word group is very important. And he has a follow-up essay in the second volume, which is not off the press yet, in which he looks at how it is handled in the LXX, and then at the Dikaiosune, the Dikaios and so on word group, that is extraordinarily important. Let me tell you a story in this regard. A number of years ago, I was in Britain, and a senior scholar, a classicist, and an expert in the LXX, but no expert in New Testament studies, pulled me aside and said, "Look, I'm reading more about the New Perspective and I don't really understand it. Explain it to me." So I sat down and gave him half an hour of what I've given to you. And eventually then came to Tom Wright's understanding of justification as God's declarative act that one is in the covenant. And his question was, asked in all naivete, he wasn't trying to be mean, does Dr. Wright know any Greek? Now, the reason for the question, you see, is that whatever disputes there are amongst Catholics and Protestants, and whatever the disputes there are historically and so on, yet nevertheless there is a profound recognition by classicists, by Septuagintal experts, by Greek experts and so on, all along the line, until fairly recently, that the Dik word group, Dikaios, Dikaiosune, Adikia, and so forth, has to do with justice, righteousness. Now, whether it's declarative or transformative or whatever, all those things are debated. But at the end of the day, it has to do with justice. And now we've got, you see, a definition that is entirely abstracted from justice. God's declarative act by which you are in the covenant community. Where's justice? Where's righteousness? It's one step abstracted. Now, in fact, that particular approach to justification is Tom's own and those who followed him. It is not common within the broader stream of current Pauline studies, apart from in that circle. What is fairly common, however, is the view, it was pushed by Käsemann and one or two others, is the view that God's righteousness is bound up with God's covenant faithfulness to Israel. God shows himself to be righteous by being faithful to his covenant. That's the nature of God's righteousness. So that the Tzedek word group is bound up, on this view, with God's covenantal faithfulness. That is how he shows himself to be righteous. That was argued by Käsemann, Westerholm pushed it in 1997. Tom Wright pushes it and then develops it further along the lines that I've indicated in his 1997 book. Interestingly enough, Adolf Schlatter, who discusses this in 1935, dismisses it as, quote, a declaration of war against Romans, unquote. In other words, he insists that if you take that view of dikaiosune and before it tzedek, in fact, you cannot possibly understand Romans, which is very interesting indeed. So there is a long-standing debate, you see, that is, in fact, quite complex in this regard. Now, it is at this point, it seems to me, that some of the studies of Seyfried are very helpful. He argues that in the Old Testament, God's righteousness is an act of God which very commonly has both a saving function and a judging function. It is part of a larger contention between God and human beings in which God is vindicated. So it's bound up, in the first instance, with the righteousness, the vindication of God. And in this contention between God and human beings, he may then save his people according to his own covenantal promises, but he may also condemn people. Thus, in a text like Psalm 98, which many people on the other side quote, "Sing to the Lord a new song, for he has done marvelous things. His right hand and his holy arm have worked salvation for him. The Lord has made his salvation known and revealed his righteousness to the nations." So the other side argues, you see, salvation is bound up with God's disclosure of his righteousness, which is part of his covenantal faithfulness. He brings about, by his own justice, his covenantal faithfulness that brings salvation. You see? But Seyfried says, no, you're not paying enough attention to the context. He reveals his righteousness to the nations. That is, the righteousness word group, he says, is regularly tied to a larger framework than the covenant. It's regularly tied in the Old Testament to creation itself. And so you read in the next verse, yes, he has remembered his love and his faithfulness to the house of Israel. All the ends of the earth have seen the salvation of our God. But by the end of the passage, you get, let the sea resound and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. Let the rivers clap their hands. Let the mountains sing together for joy. Let them sing before the Lord, for he comes to judge the earth. He will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples with equity. That is, the righteousness brings condemnation as well as salvation. And it's not just for Israel. It's universal. It's bound up with the contention between God and human beings, and God's righteousness is bound up with judgment as well as with mercy. Do you see? Now, he works through passage after passage after passage to show that that is the case. Indeed, God's righteousness, he points out, is often found in association with creational words and with words of judging. Very common. The word tzedek in this regard is used 142 times and almost never in conjunction with beri. That is the word for covenant. Almost never. Almost never. So that in the Old Testament, you keep the covenant, you remember the covenant, you disobey the covenant, but there is no Old Testament passage of doing justice by the covenant. It's not an association. Do you see? The association is with other things. So, Abraham's question about Sodom and Gomorrah: shall not the judge of all the earth render just judgment? Now, do right in our versions, but render just judgment, righteous judgment. And the assumption is, whether in mercy or in condemnation in the context. Do you see? So righteousness cannot be reduced to matters of proper relationship or the like. not even proper covenantal relationship. It involves condemning the unjust and rectifying a wrong with God being vindicated. God must be right. And that is why, in his being right, although it can be in parallel with salvation, because God can show himself right by bringing salvation to his people in line with his covenantal promises, it can't be reduced to salvation. Thus, Exodus 9:27, Pharaoh says, "The Lord is righteous, I and my people are guilty." See, over against the people, God is righteous, the people are wrong. And that's outside the covenant. This is Pharaoh and his bunch. Nehemiah 9:33, "You are righteous in everything which you have brought upon us, for you have acted in truth. We have acted wretchedly." Even, in fact, there is a forensic value to the term, not merely relational. It is God's declaration of who is right and who is wrong in contention after contention. There may be some semantic differences between saving righteousness, with the hefil stem of the verb, and retributive justice, that is, punishment and the like, in the adjective. It's not an absolute division, but there is a common associational one between the hefil form of the verb, which tends to talk about saving righteousness, and retributive justice, which tends to be the adjective. But it's not an absolute one. They're all nicely categorized for you in Zifri. Now, it's perhaps this lexical distinction that has contributed to the false conclusion that the righteousness of God always signifies saving righteousness. It's looking at a selection of texts, you see, in which the noun can be parallel to salvation, in which it can function in that way because God's righteousness is manifested precisely in saving people in line with the covenantal promises. But when it's reduced to that, it is not looking at the sweep of the term or the larger context in which this works out again and again and again. Other texts to think about. Isaiah 51:16. Isaiah 1:24-28. And so forth. There are many, many other passages in this regard. Questions about word studies now before we press on. Now I want to come to some passages, some New Testament passages in which some of these things are worked out. So if you have your Bibles with you, let's begin with Romans 1. Now, I have time here only to dip into a few passages. This is not much more than a priming of the pump, but this may be a way of beginning, at least. Begin with Romans 1:17. "For in the gospel a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith." There is no clause, no phrase in this verse that is not disputed. What can I say? And let me give you a few hints along the line that I would take it, that I would be prepared to justify at much greater length. It is justified at much greater length in one of the essays in Volume 2. There is very little of my broader argument that's going to depend on a particular judgment here. I just think that it might be useful to take you through this verse simply because it is used all the time. First, "For in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed." One of the strong arguments of Luther, You find it also in Calvin. It is stronger in Luther. And it recurs in not a few of the responses today against this new perspective. Is that justification, righteousness, dikaiosune, is not simply God's declarative righteousness, God's forensic righteousness. It's too narrow. This is not overturning classic confessionalism, but rather it is a way of showing that God's righteousness is very often a way of referring to the redemptive event rather than to the declaration. When Paul here says the righteousness of God is revealed from heaven, he's not talking about the judicial verdict. He is not talking about God's declarative act by which we are declared just within the covenant. He's certainly not talking about his covenantal faithfulness. He's talking about the gospel. It's in the gospel that he dikaiosune tou theou is disclosed. And then after the long passage then from 1:18 to 3:20 that proves that we're all condemned, he picks up in 3:21, which is a passage we're going to look at in 2 days in any case, but now dikaiosune tou theou has been made known apart from law. And what that dikaiosune tou theou is, in the context of 3:21 to 26, is, in fact, the substitutionary death of Christ on the cross. Do you see? In other words, what the dikaiosune tou theou is the great redemptive event itself, the gospel event, Christ's death and resurrection on our behalf. However that's configured, however that's understood, however it's tied to hilasterion and to the catalogue word group and all the rest, we'll come to some of that in 2 days' time. But nevertheless, it is the event itself. And then out of the event itself comes the declaration that those who have been saved by this event are declared just because of Christ's work on our behalf. In other words, it is important not to reduce justification to a declarative act. The declarative act emerges from the event, but the dikaiosune tou theou is regularly seen to be the event. Not always in Paul, but very, very commonly. And certainly in 1:17, it seems to me. It has been revealed. That is, again, Paul's understanding of the gospel revealed here in chapter 3, verse 21. It has been manifested. It has appeared. It is part of the gracious self-disclosure of the Christ event, which is not only his coming, but then his cross work and resurrection and so forth on our behalf. Then, The expression, a righteousness that is by faith, to faith, or a faith from first to last, as the NIV has it, that one is massively disputed as to what it means. I'll merely tell you what I think, but nothing that I say depends on this. It's a very minor point. I think that it means from the first covenant to the last. That is, from the first to the second, from the beginning to the end. It's always by faith. I think that's what is meant, but I acknowledge that one's disputed. There's been a recent article, in fact, which just appeared in one of the recent journals, I think it was JSNT, that argued the same line. So, again, this is not a peculiar Carsonism or anything like that. It is one of the traditional interpretations, and I think that it's probably right. Then, one of the most disputed texts in the New Testament, Habakkuk 2:4, as it's cited here, and in Galatians especially, an extremely difficult passage, loaded with textual and translational difficulties. Again, I will give you my conclusion. Nothing that I'm going to say depends on it a great deal here, but I want to press on to other passages. Just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith. In my view, the Old Testament text is not speaking of the faithfulness of the righteous one, that is, the righteous will live by his faith, although many take it that way. I don't think that's what is being said. But of the vision to which the preceding text repeatedly refers, that is, the righteous one will live by the faithfulness of the vision, not the faithfulness of the individual. And the LXX has taken it that way, though somewhat paraphrastically, by saying, the righteous one will live by my faithfulness. Now that's paraphrastic, that's not what the Hebrew says. The question is what the third person possessive refers to in the Hebrew. He will live by his faith. What is the his or its? If it's the person who is exercising the faith, then it's the righteous one will live by his faith, or conceivably his faithfulness. But if it's the vision's faithfulness, that is the faithfulness of the vision to which repeated reference is made all the way through Habakkuk 2, then, paraphrastically, that is equivalent to saying God's faithfulness to maintain the vision that he has, in fact, promised repeatedly in the chapter. So that the NIV, so that the LXX, rather, is formally wrong, but substantially correct. That is, it's referring to the faithfulness of God in maintaining the vision that has been promised again and again, since God brings the vision to reality. In other words, the one who lives by the faithfulness of the vision of the coming salvation is in view. That is, by the promise of God. It seems to me that Paul understands the text to contain an implicit call to faith based on God's faithfulness, but is not primarily at this point looking at the individual's faith, but at the faithfulness of God, as demonstrated in the vision. Now, whether you buy into that or not, this point doesn't really make a lot of difference, and it is, I fully acknowledge, an extremely disputed passage. But now it's worth coming again, once again, to reflect a little bit on the wrath of God here. We talked a bit about sin this morning, and Paul goes to great lengths to ground his subsequent argument about the atonement of Christ in the universal need. You see, I think that it is fair to say that Paul was converted so rapidly that he did not go through himself long periods of self-doubt and self-examination. The only text which suggests that he could be struggling with things is found in Acts. It's a certain reading where God addresses him on the Damascus road and says, it is hard for you to fight against the pricks or to fight against the goads. Do you see? And that has often been understood in Reform circles to be the goads of conscience or the pricks of conscience, which then presupposes, you see, that although Paul is persecuting Christians, in fact, at the same time he's struggling with a deep conscience matter within himself and the Lord's coming after him. But the expression itself does not speak of pricks of conscience. And the context is the goads that the Old Testament farmers use, the long goads with a point at the end that they use to steer their bullocks, you see? And the picture, rather, is of God steering Paul in all kinds of ways. Hard to you to fight me. I'll steer you in the direction I want to steer you, rather than pricks of conscience. You see, it is very difficult to imagine that Paul is wrestling with deep, deep, deep notions of conscience. And in fact, when Paul discusses his own pre-conversion state in Philippians chapter 3, then he doesn't speak in terms of a terribly guilty conscience. He speaks rather of, you know, as far as the law was concerned, I was blameless. This does not sound like a terribly guilty conscience to me. He sounds rather chuffed with himself, you see. Yes. Okay, we've got to stop here now for the transmutation of the tape. And while we're waiting for the tape, turn to Galatians 3. That really depends then on whether you understand that to refer to his pre-conversion mode or to his... So that's Romans 7, you see, and that has three major interpretations given to it. And it's one of the reasons why that one is such a tough passage.
Yeah. Do you really think that Paul was converted?
Pardon?
Do you really think that Paul was converted? Was he Christian?
Was he converted?
Yeah.
Yes. In fact, in the second volume of our Justification and Variegated Gnomism, we've included an essay, a 50-page essay by Peter O'Brien under the title, Was Paul Converted? See, because... Oh, I think it was. Oh, yes. Very powerfully. Yes. Yes. But you've got to define terms pretty carefully. But yes. Yes. And if it's right in line with your dissertation, I'll email you a copy of the paper. I mean... Because it's already in final revision now. We have most of the essays. We're doing all the typesetting for this one at Trinity, and we're still missing four essays, but most of Volume 2 is coming together.
I would call it like a revelation or better understanding because he was Jewish. And
yes.
I think that he recognized Jesus as Messiah.
Yes, yes.
And if that was a real conversion, that's why I think he had that conscience.
Yes.
And that's why he stressed his origins and his social and also religious statue and everything. And he was Pharisee and he was Jewish and he wanted to underscore his facts, his very facts.
Come back to me in a few minutes and see if you want to push that one some more. All right? All right? Now, this whole question of where Paul is tied in part to your understanding of Galatians 3. And in a fair bit of Reformed thought, Galatians 3 is understood this way. In my view, slightly skewed. But it's often understood this way. You see, the argument here is that Abraham was justified by faith before the giving of the law. The law cannot annul the promise. And in fact, what the law really does is function as a paedagogos, a servant who leads people to Christ. So the argument is the law properly taught and preached brings about consciousness of sin, awareness of guilt, in order to lead people to the grace of Christ. So that if you asked John Wesley, for example, how do you preach the gospel in any place? Because after all, Wesley would get on his horse and he ultimately rode 50,000 miles on horseback and go to a new place and start preaching the gospel. What do you do when you get there? And he answers in one of his letters. It's about letter 134, thereabouts. And he says, when I go to preach the gospel in any place, this is what I do. And his answer at this juncture is right out of the Puritans. Because Wesley, in many ways, although he differed from them in certain major respects, in many respects, he was really a late Puritan. In fact, Packer goes so far as to refer to Wesley as an inconsistent Calvinist, but that's that's Packer's take on it. I won't even comment on that one. But what Wesley says, however, is when I go to any place, he says, I begin with a general declaration of the love of God. And then, he says, I preach the law. I preach the law forcefully, and repeatedly, and powerfully to make people see their need, to make people see how deep sin is, how awful is their offense, and to bring people to a place where they have no excuse left anymore and begin to cry to God for mercy. And he says, when I see a few people beginning to cry in the assembly, I preach more law. And when quite a few are beginning to crack under this regime of preaching the law, then he says, I admix a little grace. And then he says, only when virtually the whole assembly is under deep conviction of sin, then he says, I preach grace fully, freely, broadly, so that men will turn to Christ, he says. And then quickly, he says, do I admix law, lest men should presume? Now, you see, that is really a Puritan view of what the Bible contains. You asked a Puritan, what is in the Bible? The Puritan would respond, law, grace, and illustrations of both. So you see, it's a self-consistent way of thinking what is in the Bible. And the categories belong to the domain of systematic theology, you see. And chapter 3, within that heritage, becomes further justification for how you then preach the gospel. You preach the gospel as the paedagogos that leads you to Christ. Now, one of the criticisms, then, of this mode is precisely the criticism that comes out of the new perspective camp. And it's partly right, in my view, and partly wrong. The right part is to recognize that chapter 3 is not to be individualized like this. It is actually talking about a reading of the Old Testament. It's talking about redemptive history. It's talking about sequence. Now, I'm going to come to that on the last 2 days where we talk about the use of the Old Testament and the New. I want to spend a lot more time on this complex question. But one of the distinctions between Paul's reading of the law and that of Judaism is this. Judaism read the law as a hermeneutical key for understanding the whole. Paul reads the Old Testament sequentially. He reads it in terms of its narrative sequence. If you asked Paul, I will come back to this question, as I say, on Tuesday and Wednesday. If you asked Paul, if you asked a first century Jew, how do you please God? The Jew would reply, by obeying the law. How does David please God? By obeying the law. How does Moses please God? By obeying the law. How does Abraham please God? By obeying the law. Hey, wait a minute, the law wasn't given. Well, yes. Genesis says that Abraham obeyed all my statutes. What do you think those statutes were, if we're going to say? He must have had special revelation from God, a special disclosure of the law. That's how you please God. Abraham obeyed the law. How did Enoch please God? Well, he obeyed the law. Wait a minute. He's only seventh from Adam. Yes, but we know that you please God by obeying the law. He must have had special disclosure, do you see? And after all, already you find Abraham apparently observing the seventh day. That's before the Sabbath is given, so he must have had the Sabbath structure. You see, he's paying a tithe before the tithe is prescribed. He must have had the tithing regulations. Do you see? He pleased God by obeying the law. Now, do you see what is going on there? Hermeneutically, the law is elevated to the place of hermeneutical control. Whereas for Paul, the proper grid here is sequence, historical sequence, chronology. So, Abraham is justified by faith explicitly in the text before the law is given. To Abraham is given the promise that in him and in his seed all the nations of the earth will be blessed, before the law is given. So if the law comes along centuries later, it cannot annul the promise. You see, Paul's whole argument here is not the function of the law in the individual conscience. Paul's whole argument in Galatians 3 is the function of the law in redemptive history. And he sees a different place for the function of the law in redemptive history precisely because he is not reading the law as a hermeneutical grid for interpreting the entire Old Testament. He's reading the law in its sequential place in redemptive history according to the Old Testament storyline. Now, I think that it is entirely correct for the new perspective to point that out. On the other hand, it's worth insisting that other biblical theologians have also pointed that out. Gerhardus Voss points it out. all kinds of commentators have pointed out in the Reformed tradition, and who break from the Reformed tradition on this point precisely by insisting that this is the way this should be read. But then the question that they would ask is this: why then does God spend centuries using the law to prepare his people for the coming of Christ? And then the argument is, well, yes, there's a whole sacrificial system that's taught and a priestly system and so on, so on, so on. We'll come to some passages of this later on with respect to Hebrews on the last day. By the last day, I mean Wednesday. I'm not speaking eschatologically. But at the same time, one of the functions was precisely, we're told, to multiply sin on account of sin, on account of transgressions, to multiply transgression and show that at the end of the day, the law is no final solution. It does lead people historically, over time, to the place where they are without excuse and leads people, in fact, to Christ. So that although Paul would say, I think that his own conversion happened very quickly, and his own perception that the law was inadequate to cope with the fact that Jesus really had died and risen on the cross, I think that's all correct. Nevertheless, there is no evidence that Paul himself goes through vast periods of time psychologically. Paul is not interested in the individual psychology of getting there. He's interested in the redemptive historical preparation for bringing the people of God to accept Christ, rather than the psychology of the individual conversion. And within that framework, then, you can understand why this sort of stance does fit in with the logic of Romans. That is to prove that all, then, are under the curse from creation. And for the Jews, under the curse of the law. And for Gentiles, under the curse of the law written on their heart. But we are all under that curse. It is the redemptive historical argument rather than the psychological individualizing argument that interests Paul. Now then, a couple of more reflections in this regard, still looking at particular texts. Think with me for a moment about the mousterion passages in the New Testament. There are 27 or 28, 26, 27 or 28, depending on textual variants. There's a textual variant where I don't think that it occurs in 1 Corinthians 2, and a textual variant where I think it does occur in Romans 16. So I take 27 occurrences in the New Testament. Some have argued for 26 and some have argued for 28. What does mousterion mean? Now, some of these passages are in Colossians and Ephesians, of course, which some will label Deuteropauline. I don't, but it's not going to make any difference to my argument. Romans 11 and Romans 16 both use the term mousterion. What is a mousterion? In the past, some have argued that mousterion is bound up with mystery religions and have seen it in terms of Hellenistic background. The overwhelming majority of scholars today now point out that that's not the way it works. It's really tied to chras in the Aramaic sections of Daniel. It's tied to notions of hiddenness in Qumran and elsewhere. It has to do with that which has been hidden in time past and is now disclosed, something along those lines. That which has been hidden in time past and now disclosed. Well, this is going to take us as well into arguments that I will develop more fully on Tuesday and Wednesday. But let me at least say this much now. There is a stream of the New Testament which argues that the gospel is simply the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. There is another stream of the New Testament which seems to argue that the gospel and its various components is essentially bound up with mystery. In other words, the gospel in the New Testament, I think we will see more fully in a couple of days from now, the gospel in the New Testament is sometimes presented as that which has been prophesied in the past and is now fulfilled, and on other occasions as that which has been hidden in the past and is now revealed. And those are quite different notions. And your understanding of whether Paul was converted is tied to that debate. For you see, on the one hand, the New Testament writers want to argue that who Jesus is and his death and resurrection are all predicted in the past. Whether they're predicted by typology or by the sacrificial system or by Yom Kippur or by Isaiah 53 or whatever, there is a sense in which New Testament writer after New Testament writer wants to argue that Jesus' death and resurrection is the fulfillment of Old Testament passages. And in that sense, you see, it would be entirely correct to say that when you become a Christian as a Jew in the first century, you're not converting to something else. You are merely staying in the line in which Scripture has already spoken. In that sense, it would be sort of meaningless to talk about conversion. On the other hand, there is passage after passage which speaks of these things having been hidden in time past and now revealed. And in that sense, you are moving to a new position. Now, it's very interesting to observe that although the gospel writers insist that Jesus' death fulfilled Scripture, they also insist that they themselves did not understand it before the event. Despite the efforts of some to argue that 4QMMT is an exception, there is no unambiguous passage that connects Isaiah 53 with a suffering substitutionary Messiah before Christ. And when Jesus is on the cross and his disciples are in the upstairs room waiting for the resurrection, they're not saying, "Yes, I can hardly wait till Sunday." They still have no categories for it. None. It's all hidden. Even though they are going to be amongst the first to insist, it was all revealed in advance. It was all predicted. And in Luke's account of things, Jesus comes along after the resurrection in Luke 24 and says, "Oh, fools and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have written." Does your brain hurt now? Because you see, there are these double streams, and I'm going to come back to them, as I say, on Tuesday and Wednesday, because these themes on justification are tied in with how you use the Old Testament. But if we accept the authenticity of the last three verses of Romans, observe how these two strands come together very powerfully. And I would be prepared to argue for the authenticity of these last three verses. They are textually disputed, but listen to this final doxology, Romans 16, 25 to 27. "Now, to him who is able to establish you by my gospel and the proclamation of Jesus Christ," so we're talking about the gospel, the proclamation of Christ, "to him who is able to establish you by my gospel and the proclamation of Jesus Christ, according to the revelation of the mystery hidden for long ages past." There's the mystery theme, hidden in times past, but now revealed. "But now revealed and made known through the prophetic writings." So was there all along. Stick that in your pipe and smoke it. You see, you've got to believe both of these axes at the same time, or you will get something wrong. The question is how they can be reconciled, how they can be put together, do you see? Now, how they can be put together, we'll come back to that question too in the last couple of days. But those sorts of debates need, it seems to me, to inform more than they have our wrestlings with questions of law and grace. For if I mistake not, Paul understands, after he's become a Christian, Paul understands the law simultaneously to condemn and to proclaim Christ in advance. So that on the one hand, here in Galatians 3, he can speak of the law being added because of transgressions. And I think because of transgressions there means to multiply the transgressions, to turn the sin and the idolatry into actual transgression of particular stipulations. On the other hand, in a passage like Romans 3, 21, there we read of a dikaiosune tou Theou, a righteousness from God manifested from heaven apart from law. That is, he means apart from the law covenant. To which, nevertheless, the law and the prophets bear witness, he says. Thus, the manifestation of this dikaiosune is apart from the law covenant. It's apart from nomos. But the nomos and the prophets bear witness to it. They're proclaiming it in advance. That turns on a certain salvation historical reading of the Old Testament sources, which we'll come to again, as I say, Tuesday and Wednesday. If I go slowly enough, it might be Wednesday and Thursday. Now, by seeing these sorts of issues, it seems to me, we are trying to look at things as Paul sees them. See, I have no objection to talking about boundary markers and self-identity issues and so forth. But if you spend all of your time on circumcision and food laws and the like as social boundary markers and not as Paul sees them within the larger framework of how to read the Bible in its salvation historical sequence, then you are focusing entirely on the horizontal matters of social identification, which concern us a great deal, but not with the issues of most fundamental importance to Paul, which have to do with how men and women can be reconciled to God. Thus, he sees the law as multiplying transgressions, not merely multiplying breaking social barriers. And the parallel in Romans, when you come to Romans 1:18 to 3:20, is proving the disastrous effect of rebellion, sin, and so on across a broad sweep that touches idolatry, greed, murder, God giving them over to all kinds of debauchery, sexual sin, on and on and on and on. These are not just social markers. There is a much bigger frame of reference in which those things are being worked out. Paul does not then see the cross merely as dealing in some way with sin analogous to the way Yom Kippur dealt with sin so that we can all be one people. He sees this as God's plan from the beginning, attested by the law and the prophets. And part of the problem of the new perspective, in my judgment, especially in the Jimmy Dunn manifestation, to some extent in the Paul in the Tom Wright manifestation, but certainly in the Jimmy Dunn manifestation, is that it is too narrowly configured on the social constructs of self-identity and not on the massive structures of how men and women can be reconciled to God. That is much closer to Paul's attempt to understand these issues in a redemptive framework. Let me give you an analogy. It's not a good analogy, but it's an analogy. If you read Marxist historiography of the Reformation, let's say some of Christopher Hill and others, then Marxist historiography of the Reformation focuses on the social identification of the German peasants and the structures of suppression and the power structure between church and the German duchies and so forth. It's cast in social movements. And there is no doubt that such things played their part. Undoubtedly. But you must still ask the question, is that what drove Luther? Have you given an adequate explanation of the Reformation once you've used exclusively Marxist categories? And likewise, I want to say, there is no doubt that there are profoundly difficult issues connected with circumcision and so on, so on, so on. But on the other hand, if all of your categories are bound up with social markers, have you come to terms with Paul? Now then, let's come to Galatians 2, verses 11 to 14. We're focusing more and more and more narrowly. Now Galatians 2, 11 to 14. This, as you may know, if you have been studying Galatians for any extended period of time, is one of the most disputed paragraphs in all of the book. And it is extremely complex. So again, I'm not going to insist the way I take it is the only way to take it. But I would like respectfully to submit that it makes a lot more sense than most of the alternatives. And I think that it clarifies some of these sorts of issues. Let me reread these verses for you. When Peter came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he was clearly in the wrong. Before certain men came from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles. But when they arrived, he began to draw back and separate himself from the Gentiles because he was afraid of those who belonged to the circumcision group. The other Jews joined him in his hypocrisy so that by their hypocrisy, even Barnabas was led astray. When I saw that they were not acting in line with the truth of the gospel, I said to Peter, in front of them all, you are a Jew, yet you live like a Gentile and not like a Jew. How is it then that you force Gentiles to follow Jewish customs? What is going on? What is the nature of the dispute? And let me tell you frankly, that one is a hot potato. But at the risk of caricature, let me suggest two ways of interpreting it. First, it is possible to take the expression certain men from James, hoi tu Jacobu, and the expression the circumcision group to refer to the same people. It is possible. And then the argument runs something like this. Now, there are many variations, but something like this. The church in Antioch is mixed race and reasonably well integrated. Exactly what's going on will depend a bit on whether you date this before the Jerusalem Council or after, and there are fine points and so on that I need not explore here. But reasonably well integrated. And when Peter first comes up, having already lived through the experiences of Acts 10 and 11, he is happy to integrate into this mixed community. And he eats, then, meals happily with both Jews and Gentiles. Then certain men from James, that is, conservative Jewish Christians from the Jerusalem camp, come up. And when they come up, they are the circumcision group. They're the more conservative bunch. And they eat on their own. They insist on eating kosher. And so when the church meets, they eat at a separate table, as it were. And they eat kosher. And initially, Peter might go with them sometime, but be with this other group, this larger group on other occasions. But gradually, he eats more and more and more with the kosher group and so identifies with them that he never eats with the rest anymore. And that makes some of the other Christian Jews in Antioch, who up to this point have been happy to be more integrated with the Gentiles, a little nervous. I mean, if Peter is going in that direction, maybe Peter, the hero of Pentecost, primus inter pares, maybe he knows something that dear old Paul, second class apostle, doesn't quite get straight. And maybe there is a kind of inside track to holiness by being conformed to the law. Do you see? So as a result, gradually some slip over in that direction, and eventually even Barnabas is snookered. That's the way it's often read, isn't it? I don't think it works. I just find it highly implausible as a reconstruction. After all, Peter, by this point, if you take the Acts account seriously, has already gone through Acts 10, but Acts 11. In other words, when he was hauled on the carpet in the Jerusalem church for the Cornelius episode, he defends himself and the Jerusalem church, in principle, agrees. That doesn't mean they're comfortable with it, but they agree. The Holy Spirit has given salvation to Gentiles as well. So that even if some Jews from Jerusalem were eating kosher, why would Peter, after those sorts of experiences, after his justification, why would he be afraid of what the Jerusalem crowd thought? That's what the text says, you see. He was afraid of those who belonged to the circumcision group. The matter's already regulated. Why should he be so afraid at this point? I mean, Peter can be a wimp, all right. He can do some pretty daft things, but this one strikes me as a little more daft than usual, and not only not courageous, but pretty stupid. I don't think it's a very reasonable reconstruction. Let me suggest another reconstruction. Now presuppose the two expressions, those from James and the circumcision group, that those two expressions refer to different people. Note that the expression "certain men from James," though it does not prove that they were envoys or messengers, it suggests it. It doesn't simply say certain Christians or certain believers from Jerusalem, but from James. If they are from James, what sort of message are they carrying? What are they talking about? What's going on? And the hint then comes along in the expression, the circumcision group. Now, that expression, the circumcision group, is, in fact, ambiguous in the New Testament. It means different things in different contexts. You've got to examine the context. In some instances, unambiguously, it refers to Jewish Christians. And under the first interpretation, it would be referring to the Jewish Christians who have just come out from James. But supposing it instead refers, as it sometimes does in the New Testament, to unconverted Jews, as it sometimes does. Then we might be able to place this historically. You find this view defended, for example, in the NIGNT commentary on Galatians and elsewhere. In the 40s, you already find cycles of persecution against the church in Jerusalem. The zealots were rising in power. So there was more and more pressure for Christian Jews to conform to Judaism in Jerusalem. Now, I think that it's important not to see here merely two groups, but an entire spectrum. I think that if I had time, I could justify this by referring to various passages in the New Testament. But let me paint a certain kind of spectrum. How does one stand with respect to the law? On the one hand, there are conservative, unconverted Jews who think that it is important to obey the whole law of God to be justified before Him. Then there are some, you could fill in other spots on the spectrum, then there are some who have become Christians in the sense that they do accept that Jesus is the Messiah. They do accept that He really is the promised Messiah. But they nevertheless think that to accept Jesus as the Messiah, you've really got to be a Jew who's covenantally bound to keep the law in the first place. Then you've got some Jews who really do understand that Jesus is the promised Messiah, and we're saved by faith in Him alone, and it is His death and not the sacrifice of a bull and a goat on Yom Kippur, which forgives your sin. And therefore, there's a profound sense in which the law doesn't have quite the same function anymore. Nevertheless, for Jews, it's important to keep the law, even if Gentiles don't have to. Then the next group over would be those who hold the same position, who nevertheless who say that you don't have to obey the stipulations of the Old Covenant anymore, but quite frankly, I'm more comfortable doing so. So that pragmatically, this group lives like this group, but their underlying rationale is a bit different. See? And that you have the next group out that is saying, well, to the Jews I become a Jew, to the Gentiles I become a Gentile, that by all means I might win some. That sounds like Paul in 1 Corinthians 9, doesn't it? See? And then you move far enough out, you might get to a bona fide antinomian, freed from the law, oh happy condition. And now... And now you see there is no constraint anywhere. And then Paul can say pretty nasty things about such a group. You know, let sin abound that grace may abound, whose damnation is just. He can be pretty blunt against that group. But clearly, those sorts of people are around, or else Paul wouldn't have to give that sort of pronouncement. So there's a whole spectrum, you see, of positions that is meant. And so when you find an expression like the circumcision group, what do you mean? To whom are you referring? Now, supposing then the situation is like this. I can't prove this. There's some speculation in what I'm about to say. But it seems to me the speculation that fits this text rather nicely. Supposing then the message that was being sent up by those from James was something like this. Peter... We remember the Cornelius episode, and we remember how the church backed you on this one, and we agree. We agree on what the gospel really is. That's not an issue. In fact, Paul has just gone on to insist that there was agreement between the Jerusalem three and Paul on the gospel, and although there are a lot of new perspective people that think that Paul is not being quite honest about that, nevertheless, take Paul at his word for it, and there is fundamental agreement on the exclusive sufficiency of Christ as the basis for salvation. But Paul, you need to understand that you've got a high profile. And meanwhile, persecution's breaking out down here. Rumors keep coming back that, you know, you're meeting with Gentiles, you're taking the whole church down this Gentile track, and every time you do this sort of thing, somebody else lands in jail down here. Just be careful, for goodness sake, Peter. You've got a high profile. Be careful what you're doing. So when the text says that Peter is afraid of the circumcision group, that's what the text says, he's afraid of them. He may not be afraid of them for his own safety. He's afraid of them, rather, because of what they're doing, according to James' report through those from James, down in Jerusalem. So from his point of view, he is trying to act wisely to spare Christians too much pain down in Jerusalem. After all, don't we read just a few verses earlier, at the end of chapter 1, that there was agreement? Peter was apostle to the Jews and Paul to the Gentiles. Peter may have felt some special responsibility. After all, he was primus inter pares as far as the Jerusalem law were concerned. So if there was a message from James, I can't prove that there was, but those from James suggest something more personal than those from Jerusalem. And if the circumcision group refers to Jews who are not converted in Jerusalem, and Peter is afraid of them, even though, quite transparently, he's not afraid of them personally. Just look how bold he is in chapter 2, chapter 3, and then later on in chapter 12. We cannot help but speak the things that we have seen and heard, and when the first whiff of persecution breaks out, you know, we've got to obey God rather. Personally, he's not afraid of them. He's prepared to go to jail for them. And then when he's persecuted personally, he counts it joy that he's honored to suffer with Christ. He's not afraid of them personally. No, it seems to me that the only way to make sense of this is to say that he was afraid because of the damage that they were doing in the increasingly persecuted church in the middle late 40s in Jerusalem. So he decides to restrict his own behavior for the sake of the Jerusalem crowd, his Christians, where he has responsibility, Christian Jews, where he's got responsibility. But Paul sees that in the Antioch context, there's a stinger in the tail. Because Peter's influence will also shape what is going on in a mixed-race church, so that the Gentiles will increasingly perceive that there are two brands of Christians, a Jewish brand and a Gentile brand. And sooner or later, that will call in question the exclusive sufficiency of Christ. And that is bound up with notions of justification. So at that point, Paul calls Peter a hypocrite. Now, not with quite the same load that is in the English word hypocrisy. Hypocrisis has to do with play-acting in some way, and it may be as mean and nasty as our English word hypocrisy, but in the context here, you can see what he's saying. Verse 14, when I saw that they were not acting in line with the truth of the gospel, I said to Peter in front of them all, you are a Jew, yet you live like a Gentile and not like a Jew. That is, he's already made it plain that he's prepared to eat non-kosher food, and he's already, he's done this with Cornelius, he's done this in Antioch, you see, he's already done this. How is it that now you force Gentiles to follow Jewish customs? You see, force, I think, merely by the diktat of his own example, of his own power. The fact that he says it publicly in front of them all, I suspect, is a very abbreviated form of a lot of private reasoning. I'm pretty sure, again, I can't prove it, that a man like Paul would have confronted Peter privately, too, and didn't get anywhere with him. But the damage is still being done publicly. So Paul goes public. And it's not pretty. Yes. And the implication, you see, of this is that Paul, then, sees that, if he's right, Peter should still insist on the unity of the church by his own actions. And if this means persecution in Jerusalem, so be it. It's the price you pay to defend the exclusive sufficiency of Christ. You do not do anything which jeopardizes the exclusive sufficiency of Christ. Not anything. And you see, there is a sense in which that is bringing you back to reformational principles. Not because the debates are exactly the same, but because in generation after generation, there will always be things, movements, tendencies, historical pressures, to sacrifice the exclusive sufficiency of Christ. Whether it's through indulgences that Luther fought, or a merit theology, or a certain view of the reading of the law, or whatever it is, Paul won't have it. His whole argument is on the exclusive sufficiency of Christ and his death as the proper ground of our justification. For it is in Christ that he dikaiosune tou theou is revealed. It is in the Christ event. Now, what I've really done now is sneaked into the biblical theology part of the argument. See? I would want to argue, in other words, that the New Perspective people are quite right to read this passage in its historical sequencing. I agree with that. You don't want to impose all the categories of the Puritans on this text and dehistoricize it. The question is not whether or not the passage has to be read in its own historical sequencing. That's not the issue. The question is whether their historical sequencing is the most believable. And I don't think it is. Just as you can have bad systematic theology, so you can have bad biblical theology. That doesn't prove that biblical theology is always wrong. Just as bad systematic theology does not prove that all dogmatic theology is wrong. It does mean that even when you see the importance of historical sequencing, you can still make huge mistakes at an interpretive level. Questions? Comments? Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I wondered in what aspect Paul's motivation was different from Peter's.
Yes.
And the answer I gave me personally after all was because Paul's motivation didn't affect the exclusive claim or that
yes.
claim of the exclusive sufficiency,
yes.
sufficiency of Christ. Is that right?
Yes. What you must really do you're right, but what you must really do to get that one right, it seems to me, is to compare Paul's attitude with respect to Titus, described in Galatians 2, with his attitude with respect to Timothy, described in Acts. I don't think that they're mutually contradictory, the way some people argue. The point is, with respect to Titus, he says that Titus was not forced to be circumcised, even though some in Jerusalem demanded it. He was not forced to, which means that the Jerusalem leaders agreed that Titus didn't have to be circumcised. But then along comes Paul and circumcises Timothy. What's going on? No wonder then in chapter 1:10 of Galatians, he is accused of being a man-pleaser. That is, you know, going with the wind depending on what was going on and not very consistent. But in fact, there is a deep principle that is at issue. If somebody is saying that you have to circumcise someone in order for him to be a Christian, Paul will say, absolutely no way. If, on the other hand, Paul thinks it wise to avoid offending Jewish sensibilities by paying for somebody's sacrifice or by circumcising Timothy so that they can get into the synagogues without raising a whole lot of questions, then fine, he'll go ahead and do it. Do you see? To take an analogy that's not very good, but nevertheless, it shows something similar. You know that in certain parts, I'm a Canadian, but in certain parts of the United States, you know that many Christians don't drink alcohol. Now, if I'm in one of those parts and everybody's going to be all upset if I drink alcohol, then I don't drink alcohol. I mean, it's not worth a fight and so on. But if somebody says to me, you cannot be a Christian and drink alcohol, I will say, pass the Beaujolais. Do you see? Because you do not ever allow anything to jeopardize the absolute sufficiency of Christ. Not anything.
This maybe raises the question, when Paul goes to Jerusalem to have the meeting with the apostles, did he go so that they can check his gospel,
yes,
or
yes.
did he go to check their gospel?
Yes, yes, yes.
Check and the sufficiency of Christ.
Yes. Did you hear the question? The question is, this raises the question of why Paul goes to Jerusalem. Did he go to have his gospel checked, or does he go to check out their gospel? Do you see? And I would say neither. His language in chapter 2 is very interesting. It is very subtle, very careful. Chapter 2, verse 2b, I did this privately, he says, to set before them the gospel that I preach among the Gentiles. I did this privately to those who seemed to be leaders. Even that expression is interesting. To seem to be leaders. It's as if he does not want to say to those who were the leaders, because that would suggest that he was a second-class apostle. And that's clearly what part of the charge is against him, that he's a derivative apostle in this first two chapters. And he says, no, I got the gospel myself directly from the resurrected Christ. I'm not a derivative apostle, you see. He's not bad-mouthing them, but he's treating them with a certain kind of care. For fear that I was running or had run my race in vain. And I think what he means by that is he is well aware that there are some people who are following him around and undermining his ministry who are claiming to come from the apostles. So when he goes to the apostles, he wants to report on all of this for fear that he's running in vain. That is to say, that every time he's doing this kind of stuff, because these people are claiming to be from the Jerusalem crowd, they're undermining him, and all he's doing is in danger of being undone all the time. What he wants from the Jerusalem apostles is not merely superficial agreement about whether or not they agree with his gospel. He wants something that will undermine those who are following him. That's what he wants. And that, it seems to me, is entirely in line then with what eventually does take place, whether you put this just before or just after the Jerusalem Council. It's entirely in line with what takes place in Acts 15. So that when the letter does go out, you see, it's our dear brothers Paul and Barnabas who have suffered many things, and we're entirely in agreement on the gospel, and so on, so on, so on. And we have heard that there are certain who have gone out from us without our permission saying, and so on. You see, it seems to me that that's what Paul is after here. He's after preserving his own ministry, not because he's got doubts about his ministry, nor even because he's sort of checking up on them as if he thinks he's superior, but because he wants to undermine those who are undermining his ministry.
And then he opposes Peter because Peter said that the council is not that the Gentiles have to become Jews.
Yes.
We have to become Gentiles in Acts 15:9. We are saved the way they are.
Yes, we are saved the way they are, but not that we all then become Gentiles, but rather that we become Christians. And you see, Paul sees himself, it seems to me, this is very clear from 1 Corinthians 9, in what has sometimes been called a tertium quid, that is to say, in the third position. So that in 1 Corinthians 9, 19 to 23, he says, not, I am a Christian Jew, who then flexes to become a Gentile. He says, I am a Christian, and I become a Jew, or I become a Gentile. So, he says, to those who are under the law, I become like one under the law, though I am not myself under the law, in order to win those who are under the law. You see? So, he has to flex to become a Jew. And on the other hand, he has to flex to become a Gentile, because he's in neither position. He's in the tertium quid. Now, in all fairness, that's not always the way Paul speaks. In certain contexts, he thinks of himself quite clearly and unambiguously as a Christian Jew. Thus, for example, in Romans 9, he has great sorrow of heart for his kinsmen according to the flesh. You see, he's proud of his Jewish heritage and thankful for it. And likewise in Philippians, yeah, he understands that he's from the tribe of Benjamin and so on. So he's not denying that. But nevertheless, in terms of how he sees himself related to the law, he sees himself in a tertium quid. And he's got to flex to win this group, and he's got to flex to win that group. But he doesn't quite belong to either group. He's a Christian. Which brings us back to the question of, you see, of whether he sees himself as converted or not. Oh yes, oh absolutely, oh yes. I'm not denying that for a moment. Neither would Paul. But the advantage is a first and foremost a salvation historical advantage. And in Paul's thought, first in grace, first in judgment. But that's also a Christian disclosure. Peter says the same thing in his first epistle. Judgment begins with the household of God. Now, there are more things to be said about this, and I haven't even got to the last two points, but my watch tells me it is time to break up. And tomorrow we'll abandon this subject and we'll turn to questions of postmodernism. And in the last 2 days, we'll turn to questions of the use of the Old Testament and the New. All right? In other words, this is a sequence of seminars that does nothing well.